In the recent workshop that I had in Bethany College, we discussed the role of gender in the Godhead, and the idea was that not everybody had a really good experience with their father, and so the idea of God being a father, sometimes kind of people don't understand that. They get the pain of what they may have had in a relationship with their father. And so they, when we talk about God as Father, that wells up in them, and they remember that and recall that. And so we talked about the parents, godparents, mother and father. And I think that has its merits for sure, because in today's settings, there's a lot of people who don't have a good experience with their fathers, or may not even know them. While most men can be a father of a child, it takes a lot more to fulfill what a father's need is for a child. Fathers are central in the emotional well-being of their children, and they are capable of being caretakers and disciplinarians. I think sometimes in the recent, where we are going, and us men have gotten beaten up pretty good in the news lately. And especially the white males sometimes, and we're not all that way. We are loving parents, and not all of us run away from our children and our responsibility. But it seems lately we have got a little bit, maybe some of us deserved, I don't know. But we certainly should look at our role as fathers. Studies show that a child's father a child whose father is affectionate, supportive, and involved contributes greatly to the child's cognitive, language, and social development, as well as the academic achievements, and a strong inner core resource, and a sense of well-being, and self-esteem, and authenticity. I think fathers do have a lot to contribute. Mothers do too, but this is Father's Day, so we're talking about fathers. Your child's primary relationship to his or her father can affect the child's relationship from birth to death, including those with friends and lovers and spouses. It does have an effect on people's lives. I think really the best kind of relationship one can have is having a father and a mother. But we know as well as that only about, 20%, I think later on here in a couple of minutes, 20%, of the American families have both a father and a mother in them. That's really quite a shameful thing. But there's other ways that we can contribute. Girls look to their father, or look to for patterns of look to their man that they're looking for in the patterns of their good old dad, you know, and what and how that relationship was. That carries through. Believe it or not, we know that. Socially, that women look, you know, they only know and their relationship to their male counterpart that they're looking for a lot of times is a lot of what their father contributed. If a father is kind and loving and gentle, they will reach for these characteristics in their men. But if the girls are come up in an otherwise relationship that is not the best, then a lot of times they end up in that same relationship. You repeat it over and over again. It's a cyclical thing. Breaking that pattern is not always easy to do. Boys, on the other hand, will model themselves after their fathers. They look to their fathers for the approval of everything they do. They in their success and their, what have you. Their fathers have a lot to do with it. Thus, if a dad is abusive and controlling and domineering, these same patterns are passed on to their son. However, if a father is loving, kind, and supportive, and protective, boys will want to be like that. We know that socially is true in some respect, that you know we are what we how we grew up a lot. And breaking that cycle sometimes is not always easy. You know, we have a learned behavior in some degree. But it can be changed. That's no question about it. Not everybody fits in the same model, for sure. Human beings are social animals, and we learn by modeling behavior. And these patterns are determined early on. It's really impossible to overestimate the importance of a dad. Again, it's learned that there's some educators in here. You may know this or may not. I don't know. I got this article from the Huffington Post. So it's I'm just repeating what they have. I have didn't actually research some of this stuff. I'm assuming that it's somewhat correct. But it says girls who have a good relationship with their fathers tend to do better in math. I don't know. And boys who have an active and actively involved father tend to have better grades and perform better on achievement tests. I don't know. You some people here may or may not support that. I don't know. Changing roles in families, though. There's a lot of changing roles. We don't have typical families anymore. And like I said, 20% of the American household consists of married couples with children. That's really rather low, really. And finding the gap in a family structure of all kinds. There is a various different ways we can work things out. Just because there's divorce and what have you, when they are engaged, fathers can make a big difference. You know, whatever kind of model you have, if you're involved, that is better. He may be a classically married, single, divorced, widowed, gay, straight, adopted stepfather, a stay-at-home dad, or a primary family provider. But it's important for the father to be involved in whatever situation it is. I know most of us here have our children grown. I'm probably just repeating a lot of things that we may know. At an older age, we look back and reflect upon our lives and wonder sometimes whether we did everything right. I know sometimes, I guess every one of us could consider, if we look back and reflect and ponder, we would say there would probably be some things that we would probably change. But then again, how do we know that? The emergence of women in the job market has ever changed the roles of families and mothers. Most of us would agree with that. Traditionally, women stayed home and worked, made cookies. We've heard that phrase before. That's not the case anymore. I have to watch how I say that. I might get things thrown at me. But nevertheless, with the rise of feminism and the shift of women working, about 60% of the women work nowadays, according to this statistic. And that adds to the shift in marriage, divorce, lower birth rates, and family structures of all different kinds. There seems to be a softening of changing the traditional parenting roles. I hear of men who, you know, nurture their children, change diapers, and, you know, help out. That's the changing and the flexibility of where we are. Basically, we can be involved as parents and as family, and I think we know that is to be true. I think as the society continues to break down, we're going to continue to have more problems as time goes along. I'm going to read the scripture now. Where am I? Oh, here we are. Mark 3:7-12. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake. A large group from Galilee followed. When they heard about all he was doing, many people came to him from Judea, Jerusalem, and Idumea, and regions across the Jordan and around Tyre and Sidon, because of the crowd, he told his disciples to have a small boat ready for him to keep the people from crowding him. For he had healed many so that those with disease were pushing forward to touch him. Wherever the impure spirits saw him, they would fall down before him and cry out, "You are the Son of God." But he gave them strict orders not to tell others about him. I save my little funny story for the day. We'll see how it flies. 90-year-old Sam bought a hairpiece. He had a facelift and worked out in the gym for 6 months. Then he found a widow half his age to take to dinner. And as they got out of his sports car, Sam was struck by lightning and died. At heaven's gate, he ran up to God and says, "Why me?" "Oh, Sam," replied God, "I didn't recognize you." Causes us to ponder a little bit, now doesn't it? I don't know. That has certainly caused me to ponder and think for a little bit, and that's the title of the message. And one of the things that jumped out at me in the scripture was, when I first read it, was that Jesus did want to have a pause, that Jesus needed a pause to get away and to ponder. He had just healed, in a message before, he had just healed a man's hand, and the Herodianites were plotting to kill him. There was people plotting to kill him, and his fame was getting to the point where people in power were starting to notice. And so Jesus needed to get away, I think, and what I believe, to go up to the mountain and to ponder, and to pause and ponder. Luke says that he went up into the mountains and he prayed all night. There's different accounts. I find that to be just fine. Different accounts are just fine. As most of us, I think, sometimes in our lives, we need to take a pause and ponder. We look back on our lives and we say times in which we have taken them. We see high marks in our life. I just turned 65. I was told that I shouldn't, at the funeral of Sam Chilson, Roger Chilson told me, he said, he's 80-something, I think he was. He said, "You shouldn't look at 65 as something like you're getting old, but you achieved a high mark in which a lot of people haven't got to there, didn't live that long." And I said, he said, "That's how you should look at it. You achieved a high mark in your life." And I certainly took that to heart and said, yeah, you're right. A lot of people don't make that. So it made me stop and ponder, and to pause and to ponder. And there's probably many times in my life that I have stopped and pondered along the way. I can remember, high points in my life, 16 when I had my driver's license, 21 when I became of age, I could go to the bars legally. And, these were high points in my life, and marriage and my first child, these are high points in your life. But they do cause you to stop and to ponder. And I want to go back and I want to look a little bit into some of the text and tell a story, just a short story, and deal with what's in the Bible as far as stopping and pondering. I think that in the present day, which I will get to in a minute, the Middle East and policy that is being formed by the government kind of does make me pause and ponder a lot. Right now these days, I have to admit, and there's some things which I'm going to look at, just a couple little things, but I think we should be well aware around us what's going on and be relevant. I think a lot of times, my concluding thought was that we tune out. There's so much going on, we tend to tune out, and we forget. We forget our past, as we talked about out here in Sunday school. It just repeats itself. It seems like it could be a cyclical over and over again, and keeps going. And one of the ideas that really disturbs me is the rebuilding of the temple. And what's going to wants to happen? Some zealous people want to rebuild the temple, and I'm going to show this morning a little bit of a story of the cyclicalness of the temple built. The Jewish society rose, and then it went down, and then it went up, and it went down, and we're at a point again where we're going to repeat the same thing over again. And most people, I think, believe that when Moses took the children of Israel into the promised land, that was the first time they occupied it. But that's not true. Abraham occupied it long before Moses took them over there. He left the land of Ur, which was somewhere around Kuwait, and journeyed up the Tigris Euphrates and went into the Promised Land. And there he had two children. We know one from his slave woman and one from his wife later on. And Sarah, who had a child, I always get them mixed up, Jacob and Esau. I think that's what he had. But God chose Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons. And one of them was Joseph. And that's the one I want to look at here shortly. And Joseph was the second to the youngest. And most people would think that traditionally the oldest son always got the blessing. Well, there's many times in these stories of Genesis in which the oldest one didn't get the blessing. It was the youngest one. And that was kind of confusing in a lot of different ways. I'm not going to really look at that, but that's just something you can keep in your mind. And where I want to start out is Genesis 37, where Joseph was sold into slavery. Now, his brothers didn't like him. He was special by Jacob. He was Joseph was his special son, and he liked him more than anyone else of the 12 that he had. I see that sometimes as I see that in relationship with fathers and their sons, and I look at that and I say, ooh, that's a little touchy there. You should treat your sons equally. But Jacob didn't. He made at 17, he was taking care of the flocks and the sheep. His father was a rich man, and he made him a special coat. I don't know, most of us know the story that when we were growing up, a coat of many colors. There's a lot of symbolism that could go in there. He made him a very special coat. And so he stood out from his brothers, and he was special in his father's eye. And he had a dream. And he had a dream in which there was like sheaves of grain. I don't know if there's still a few of them around. The Amish still make sheaves. And one rose, it said, we were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood. This is Joseph saying this. My sheaf rose and stood upright while the sheaves gathered around it bowed down. And that's symbolic of Joseph was going to rise up in power and the rest of the sons were going to bow down to him eventually. This is in his dream. Well, they got upset. They hate him even more yet. And you mean to tell me that you're going to reign over us? See, traditionally, the oldest one always reigned, got the blessing and ruled over the rest of the children. He was the father, eventually, in the hierarchy. He rose to the top. But in this case, Joseph is telling him in a dream, that's not going to happen. And then he had another dream, basically the same thing. He says that Joseph says, listen, he said, I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. Well, that's similar to the same thing, meaning that the 11 sons were going to eventually bow down to Joseph. But then he told his father as well. And he said his father rebuked him. He said, no, wait a minute, son, this isn't right. This is not traditionally correct. This shouldn't happen. Well, that's as far as I'm concerned, I can see that a father is trying to keep the peace here in this and say to Joseph, wait a minute. You mean to tell me that, will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? And this made his brothers even jealous yet. But here's the point that what his father did. His father kept the matter in his mind, or in some translations, he pondered it. So his father didn't tell him that he was totally wrong. He didn't ridicule him, but he said, I'm just going to ponder it. Well, later on, that's exactly what happened, Joseph got sold into slavery. He ended up in Egypt, and he became the second in command in Egypt, in the Pharaoh, and there was a great famine, and Isaac and his family, it's a long story. I'm going to just cut to the chase because I want to move on. And due to the famine and the drought, they moved their family all to Egypt. And there they populated and grew. So they left the land of Canaan and went into Egypt, where Moses eventually brought them out. And again, it wasn't too much longer. Once they got taken out, and Moses brought them out, and they went into the promised land, Solomon built an immense temple. It was a beautiful temple, but it didn't last long either. Eventually, Solomon reigned about 970 to 931 B.C. before Christ, and he was the glory days of the Israelite people. This is where they want to go back to now. Now today, they want to go back to these glory days of Solomon, in which Solomon reigned, and he was a very powerful man. They had a beautiful temple, and this is where when you're talking here about Zionists and rebuilding the temple, this is where they want to go. They want to go back to this time in which they reigned and their splendor. But that didn't last real long. Nebuchadnezzar came along about 587 and destroyed the temple and took the Jewish people into captivity and went to Babylon. I think Babylon now is Iraq, I think, if you remember right. That's where, King Hussein wanted to rebuild the Nebuchadnezzar's gardens and what have you. He never got to do that. But in Psalms 37, it says, "By the river of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion or Jerusalem. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for a song. Our tormentors demanded a song of joy. They said, 'Sing us one of your songs of Zion.' But they couldn't do it because they were held in captivity. They lamented and looked back." Lamentations is a long story about a time period, this time period when they lamented. They wondered why they were held in captivity. And they, in some ways, pondered and reflected. They looked back on the time in which, the great time of their day. Around 400, somewhere thereabouts, the temple was rebuilt again. But it never had the Ark of the Covenant in it. The Ark of the Covenant ended with King Solomon. It was replaced with a big slab of a stone. And it was a pitiful sight, it says in the Bible, compared to what the days of Solomon was. Jerusalem, but nevertheless, the temple was built. So the temple during Jesus' time was up and built. It was barely finished by the time in 70 after the Common Era, after Jesus. And it was destroyed again. And there remains destroyed. Now they want to build it again. Jerusalem was attacked about 52 times. It's one of the oldest cities in the world. It was captured and recaptured 42 times, according to... and it was destroyed twice. We are at the time again where we have cycled around again, in which we are about to rebuild it again. Whether you believe it or not, or whether you hold it to be as part of your faith, a policy is being formulated to structure around rebuilding the temple. Our embassy got moved to Jerusalem. I heard this week and last week, I heard some really disturbing things that really kind of upset me or kind of made me stop and ponder. I had to pause and ponder whether or not I really was questioning whether or not whether or not the temple would ever get rebuilt because there's a mosque on it. That's the big problem. There's a mosque that needs to be taken away. I heard a comment about 2 weeks ago out of the current administration that we needed to produce steel, enough steel, so that if we have a war, we can, in case Russia comes down and invades the Middle East, that we have enough of steel and can produce enough steel to make enough armaments to go to war. That comment is a direct comment to an end of the time scenario. Magog and Magog war. It's called the war that is believed to happen by some people. Evangelicals firmly believe the Battle of Armageddon, which is whether we think it's goofy or not or don't believe it, there are a big swath of people that do believe it. And policy is being formulated, in my estimate, to deal with this. There is a gentleman, Jay Sekulow. He is the president's, one of his highest lawyers. He's a what I call a rabid evangelical Zionist. He's going to support Jerusalem no matter what. And he, in effect, is jabbering in our president's ear. I believe that the tariffs that we put on Canada and around is an effort to do just that, to make our country, to build its steel more. We want to bring the steel production back, and that worries me. That worries me an awful lot. But that's nevertheless is the way it is. And another thing that really hit my radar screen this week was when the Attorney General talked about formulating policy, the immigration policy, over what it says in Romans, that we should be obedient to the government. And that really, really worries me, that if we're going to start using scripture in a way that is to support a particular idea, I am really concerned about that. We are going down a path, I think, that really causes me to pause and ponder. I really, I don't know what you feel about that, but I think sometimes, as I said earlier, things are happening so fast, and so the news is constantly putting a lot of stuff on. We kind of lost our way of spiritual education. We don't know what the Bible has to say, and so we're just doomed to repeat it again. And the sad reality is, I think, as we commented earlier today, that we're heading to the point where war is possible again. And I am certainly have pondered that reality. We haven't learned, and we don't seem to learn. Another thing that bothered me this week was we had a tornado over in our area, and there were some houses that were wiped out. And I went to a neighbor yesterday, it's a truck junkyard, or salvage yard. You don't like to be called a junkyard, it's a salvage yard, used parts. And we talked about it. We didn't know how to help. He said, I'd like to take some money down and give it to him. He says, but I don't know where to give it to and how to do it. I said, it really bothers me. I said, I don't know how to help. I don't know how I can help. Does throwing money at something solve the problem? I don't think so. How do you help? How do you help somebody whose house is totally wiped out and doesn't have nothing? How do you know what they need? I don't know. We've talked about it for about a half an hour. We did not come to an understanding on how we can reach out and help our neighbors who live simply right down the road. How do you do it? I don't know. These are things that caused me to pause and ponder this week. I don't have an answer. I can't tune it out. But what do we do? Even in our local community around here, we are limited on how we help. How do we help? We expect our government to help, but they say it's not a big enough disaster. Then what? How do we help? And that's the question I'm going to leave you with. Amen.
Higher, and I'm touched by your grace. You send me have surrounded me, and my lighthouse through every storm. You keep on pushing me, even though I'm worn. My Father will be there with me. How can it be? I'm amazed by your glory. You know about my story. I'm amazed day by day, and by you in every way.
May they be used to spread your word